Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I'll be talking to Stephen Bush and George Eaton about the migrant crisis in the Mediterranean and the last days of the Labour leadership election. Then Caroline Crampton joins me and Stephen to talk about Terry Pratchett's final book. It is the first week back for politics after the summer. Parliament ends its summer recess next week, and I'm joined by George Eaton, our politics editor, and Stephen Bush, editor of The Staggers, to talk about it. George, I just want to talk to you first quickly about the migrant or refugee situation that's developed over the last couple of days. I know you just tweeted that the petition, as we record this, has gone over 100,000 for it to be debated in the Commons. Cameron's under a lot of changing his stance, which is that we will not take more refugees from the Middle East. Is that likely to remain the case, do you think?
I think he will have to move. I mean, whether he moves as far as some such as Yvette Cooper wants, Yvette Cooper's called for Britain to take at least 10,000, isn't certain, but I don't think he will be able to make, we can't take more and more refugees, when of course the UK has only accepted 216. As you say, the petition's passed 100,000, that's the threshold at which the government has to consider a debate, and surely it will accept one. You've had The Sun, the country's biggest selling paper, and of course loyal supporters of Cameron, who have called for him to U-turn. Ruth Davidson, the Scottish Conservative leader, has said, you know, this is at odds with British traditions, and if this is a humanitarian emergency, it's not a question of migration, and if we don't act, what does that say about us? So, and I even think public opinion is often shifted quite quickly by the horrific photos we've seen. Mm. So I think even the politics of it, which is presumably part of Cameron's considerations, may not be favourable for him.
And Stephen, I want to ask you about Yvette Cooper's intervention saying that we should take 10,000 refugees, because Labour were criticised a lot, not least by you during the election campaign, for things like the mug that said, you know, we need controls on immigration, and for kind of conceding quite a lot of ground to anti-immigration sentiment. Do you think that whoever the next Labour leader is, that that will be a tenable position? Or will they try and draw a distinction between migrants bad, refugees good? Is that the sort of simple way out of this?
I mean, I've actually done a bit of a U-turn on this, in that I still regard, I mean, obviously the mug was ridiculous from both aesthetic and political reasons, but ultimately I have looked at all of the numbers from the defeat, because I would love to be able to construct this argument that Labour should have been more, as I see it, honest about the benefits of immigration, less with it. But unfortunately, I cannot make those numbers go together. Mm. It probably did lose them to some votes to the Greens in London, Liverpool and Manchester, where they won bumper crops of seats. It probably made Caroline Lucas's majority a bit bigger in Brighton Pavilion. Did it change the election? No. That said, I thought it was a brilliant speech. I think one of the strange aspects of this leadership election is this way that after it's ended, effectively, when people are voting and making up their mind, Yvette Cooper has suddenly turned into this brilliant speech giver. She's on two in 2 weeks. It is really weird. It feels as if she suddenly realised that there's a leadership contest on and she'd actually quite like to win it. It was a brilliant speech. Not as good as her Manchester speech, but still very good. I mean, under Corbyn, they will have a much more loudly pro-immigration tone. Actually, they would have a more loudly pro-immigration tone under Kendall. Under Cooper, you'd expect them to have to maintain the more hostile tone they have under Miliband. She was a big architect of things like the mug, the pledge. At the Home Office, she and her team were sort of among the most sceptical of the values of migration, and obviously it was a factor in Ed Ball's losing his seat in Morley and Outwood. Yeah, so the pessimistic answer is, it may be that you can't at the moment have a line as a Labour Party on migration that allows you to hold together your voters in big cities and voters in small towns that you need to win. It might simply be that there isn't a politician who's able to weld those two things into a winnable coalition. Jeremy Corbyn is speaking very effectively to people in big cities. He's going to do very well in Stoke Newington, where I live. There is no evidence as yet that he will do anything other than flop in small towns.
I think Scotland's a really interesting one for this as well, because there is a lot of kind of, but Jeremy Corbyn, you know, people are voting in an anti-austerity way in Scotland. Jeremy Corbyn could win back Scotland, which is, I'm afraid, just not an analysis that I buy. There was a poll out this morning there saying that there'd be a majority in support of independence. It's widely expected next year's Holyrood elections, there will be actually just a total wipeout. The SNP will take everything in the constituency system. They'll do so well they won't get topped up by any list MPs. And I think at that point, probably, maybe the English Welsh Labour has to accept that people aren't voting for the SNP because Labour isn't left-wing enough. I don't know. I mean, George, that is still, like, I think, quite an unpopular thing to say in some quarters, but I think people voting for the SNP is about more than being anti-austerity.
I think, actually, the good thing about Corbyn winning is it is forcing a lot of people who have said that the SNP are an anti-austerity force for internal political reasons to be more honest about what it is that is going on there. What is the SNP's signature policy achievement in Holyrood? It's a council tax freeze, which is effectively austerity of exactly the kind Eric Pickles is driving for the Department for Government, where you just pass the cuts on to local government. And it's an expansion of the welfare state to the middle classes. Now, there are strong kind of tactical arguments for things like universal pensions, ending fees. It's much harder to get rid of universal services. It's not a coincidence that the most enduring bits of New Labour's legacies are paid for bank holidays, paid leave, free museums, three things which aren't used by working class people, but they're also used by middle class people, journalists, lawyers, etc., etc.
Well, that was one of the FT's conclusions about the cuts to councils, is that they had fallen incredibly disproportionately brutally on a very small number of people, particularly in regards to care budgets. So there are people, the same thing with the bedroom tax, there are a small number of people whose lives have been absolutely devastated, but for the majority of ratepayers, they've felt absolutely nothing. And in fact, they're very happy about their council tax being frozen. George, I know it seems so close now, finally, the Labour leadership result. I just wanted to check in, really, that everything is being written and talked about at the moment as if Jeremy Corbyn is an absolute dead cert. Is that true?
I'm 90% certain that he'll win. All the polls point that way, CLP nominations, all of the campaigns, canvas returns suggest that he's ahead on first preferences, even if he doesn't win in the first round, which is possible, although it's quite possible that he will. He'll have a large enough lead to carry him through on second preferences.
And in your column this week, you've talked about what we tend to call the Blairites, what we now, I suppose, more properly would call the kind of right of the party, really. And there's a great line in it where you sort of talk about, you know, this is a group of people for whom winning elections is the mantra. This is what they supposedly offer to the Labour Party. And yet they haven't been able to put forward a candidate who can do that. What's the calculation for them post-Corbyn victory?
It's very interesting. Of course, being the most ideologically opposed to Corbyn, they initially took a very hostile stance. So you had Chukwuemunna, Tristram Hunt, Chris Leslie, Emma Reynolds and others come out quite early after he became the front runner and said we would not serve under him. What's interesting now is now it seems inevitable that he'll win, and those sorts of threats clearly haven't proved effective in stopping him. You've had some who are taking a much more conciliatory stance. So Chukwuemunna said this week in a speech that all MPs should accept the result and support their new leader, which was an olive branch to Corbyn. And he's now saying, were Corbyn to change his stances on issues such as nuclear disarmament, NATO, the EU, and taxation. So it's quite a long list.
I love that bit. Were he to dump pretty much everything that he stands for?
Were Jeremy Corbyn to rip out everything he's ever stood for? He might consider serving his shadow cabinet. Now, I don't think there's any chance that Chukwuemunu will sit in a Corbyn shadow cabinet. But I think he's trying to play a smarter game in being seen to at least be prepared to engage with Corbyn. And so he can say, we had a discussion, we have too many irreconcilable differences, but you know, I wish him well and I will support him from the back benches, while also putting forward, you know, my own vision of what Labour should stand for. He recognises that Labour has attracted hundreds of thousands of new supporters. It's for his wing of the party to try and work with them rather than to try and simply oppose them if it ever wants to win again.
And Stephen, what happens with the whip? This has been my my consistent question about what a kind of Corbyn era means when you have the party's most rebellious MP over a course of, you know, 2 decades. It's not just that he didn't like New Labour. He was rebelling before New Labour. What happens? How does he keep his MPs in line?
Well, the lesson of Ian Duncan Smith, who is the closest analogue, although Ian Duncan Smith, you know, was in the shadow cabinet before he became leader, is he probably won't. MPs are very reluctant to vote for things that they feel, you know, to show loyalty that they feel has not been shown to them. The big difference in this occasion is I expect he will win a strong mandate among members. That matters not because the £3 scheme is illegitimate, although some people think it is, but because if MPs fear that they will be deselected if they are too mouthy about Jeremy Corbyn, then they're not going to be... The big dynamic, if you are, say, John Woodcock, the MP for Barrow and Furness, which is where the actual nuclear subs are based, there is nothing that your CLP can do to you, no matter how much they love Corbyn, that the voters aren't going to do... Mm. If Labour goes into the 2020 election saying it will get rid of their jobs, their bases, their yada yada yada. So if you're him, or if you're Wes Streeting as a majority of 500, or, you know, Peter Kyle, who's also one of the MPs elected against the tide, majority of about 1,000, I think. Those MPs who managed to, like, campaign their way to victory in 2015 are not going to be that loyal. To be honest, not for ideological reasons. For the same reason that actually... If you look at the 2010 election, you know, Andrew Smith in Oxford East, you know, a Brownite in every sense, you know, played up, I voted against this, I voted against that, I didn't stand on this, I will not vote for tuition fees, I don't agree with my manifesto on this. MPs will do what they have to do to survive. In safe seats, that will mean voting with Corbyn. In marginal seats, that will, I imagine, unless I'm hugely wrong and Corbyn surges in all the polls and Corbyn mania hits Middle England, that will mean being rebellious. But ultimately, the voters, whether they are voters in CLPs or voters in constituencies, will be the ones who decide.
Well, on that note, we've only got one more of these before the result announced. I know, it feels like a sort of like epic box set. But for the moment, thank you, George and Stephen.
I'm Caroline Crampton, and now I'm going to talk to Helen Lewis and Stephen Bush about Terry Pratchett. The context for this being that last week they published the final Discworld novel, The Shepherd's Crown, which is the last we'll ever hear from Granny Weatherwax and Tiffany Aching. Helen, you've written your column about it in this week's magazine, and it's all on the theme of goodbyes.
Yes, exactly. So that's why I'm forcing you to chair this particular one, because I've got lots of things to get off my chest. The reason I wrote the column, and I should say that there are spoilers ahead, but I don't think it is a spoiler. So, Granny Weatherwax dies in this book, and she's somebody who's introduced in the third Discworld book, Equal Rights, which was written in before I was born, I think. I think it was in the 1980s. And she's one of my favourite character. But I don't think that her death is a spoiler per se in terms of discussing this, because the way it's dealt with in the book is really interesting. It is the polar opposite of a kind of George R.R. Martin kind of, like, you know, that favourite character, and then suddenly they're gone. Because she, like all witches, has a premonition of her death. It comes to her when she's cleaning the privy, and she cleans her house, she gets everything ready, she marks out where she wants her grave to be in the woods, and she lies down, puts out 2 coins for the ferryman, and she changes her sign from "I ain't dead" to "I is probably dead." and she dies quietly in her sleep. And what I thought was so brilliant about the way that it was handled was it was like a real death, in that it doesn't mean anything. there's no big point to it. It doesn't alter the course of history per se. You know, it's not, it's the opposite of one of those kind of grandiose.
It's not a plot point.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It is just a thing that happens to people in life and everybody else has to deal with it and go on. And obviously, because she's a very important character, you kind of see the reactions of people all across the disc to this. But Tiffany Aching then kind of inherits her mantle and again has to repel an invasion by the elves, which was the plot of Lords and Ladies. And she has to try and live up to the legacy of Granny Weatherwax. I thought it's... knowing that Terry Pratchett wrote this book when he probably knew it was his last book, I mean, he has a note at the end from Rob Wilkins, his assistant, which said that he would write several different books at one time, so he would dip in and out. So it's hard to know that it was, you know, definitely the final one. But he was diagnosed with this early onset Alzheimer's in 2007, so ever since then he felt it was a race against time. Wilkins says that, you know, he measured every other thing that he did about whether or not, like, how many writing days was that going to take away from him, because he just had so many things he wants to get down, really. But yeah, I'm pretty glad that he got this one down.
Mm. Stephen, I know you're very keen on the Discworld novels. Is Granny Weatherwax your favourite character, or are there other people you like more?
No, I think it has to. It's either Granny Weatherwax or Death. But the Death books are kind of... The really nice thing about him finishing this one is all of the kind of recurring characters, Vimes, Death, I'm going to forget someone and the internet will get angry with me, had sort of, I think, been, if not finished, had been resolved. It was the witches who were the only one who had been left, who, you know, if he hadn't written this one, would have been left kind of at a point where you've gone, oh, so, you know, Vimes is now sort of master of all he surveys, top cop. You know, he's kind of...
He's got little Sam. Sybil's got the Lady Sybil Hospital for Sick Dragons. Like, that's all... Yeah, I know what you mean. That's all resolved. Yeah. Death has had his holiday in Reaper Man and is now back just to deathing. The goblins have been free, so we've heard a lot about that. And
even Susan, Death's granddaughter, has effectively been married off at the end of Feast of Time. So this was the only one kind of left to finish. And the nice thing about it is... I was terrified when I've just got back from holiday, and I read it on holiday, and I was terrified and it would be rubbish, because, to be honest, Raising Steam, the one before this, wasn't...
It was very stream of consciousness, and I think that's an interesting thing. Like, one of the things I've written about in the column is that I don't think I will ever love an author the way I love Terry Pratchett again. You know, there was someone wrote a column once about there were certain novels that needed to have a kind of use-by date in them. So, like, if you don't read Catcher in the Rye by the time you're sort of 17, you might as well not bother, really, because
it will seem rubbish.
Because, like, in the way that I'm determined I'm never going to go back and watch the...
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Excellent, but probably not excellent TV series bottom, because I don't think it was actually that good. It was just that as a 15-year-old, that was exactly what I needed in my life. But I first read Mort was the first one I read when I think I was probably about 10 or 12. And it was absolutely extraordinary, and it was so forward thinking for the time. I mean, I think that's one of the things that's fascinating about it. You know, fantasy as a genre has got so embroiled recently in all these controversies. You know, there's been this stuff about the Hugo Awards, and about the lack of kind of interesting female characters and non-white characters. And Terry Pratchett did all that 10 years ago, but in a way that wasn't hitting you on the head with stuff. So, Ankh-Morpork, which is the capital city, is a multicultural city.
Yeah.
It's just that he does it with trolls and dwarves and now goblins, and he writes about immigration, but he does it through other species
and also sort of inter-community tension. I have not read nearly as many books as you guys have, but I have read Thud, which is all about sort of two different
the battle
between two different sort of tribes or species even who have different ideas about how they want to integrate into society.
Yeah, and he was doing pretty out there stuff on gender as well. So in the early books, the idea is that all dwarfs are, you know, whether or not they're male or female, they all have like giant great beards and big booming voices and iron boots. And then you get, first of all, Cheery Little Bottom, who becomes Cherry Little Bottom, and Watch, who decides that she wants to wear like high-heeled boots. She wants to like weave her beard attractively. So she decides that she wants to express herself in a feminine way. And that's incredibly alienating, and it's one of those things that's a long tradition of science fiction and fantasy, going back to things like Ursula Le Guin's Left Hand of Darkness, about actually trying to think of other alternate conceptions of gender without, you know, whilst that is not the plot, but that is just something that happens, saying that things you take perfectly for granted in this world, what does creating a world where those things aren't the case
look like? I think that's why people get so het up about sci-fi and fantasy, is if you're making up a world from scratch, it can have anything you want in it, so why replicate the worst structural problems of our own world?
And I think what I like about the kind of small-L liberalism of the Praxy books, apart from Thud, which does, I think, lay it on a bit thick.
Yeah.
Is mostly...
I like that one.
But it is a bit the kind of, and then they, you know, because you, I thought, what, because so the idea is the premise that there's an old battle that happened between the trolls and the dwarfs that they always refer to, and then you find out at the end that it was all, they sort of sat down at a chess match, I think that's what I'm kind of coming back to. And it was kind of, and you felt a sense of inevitability about that ending, that actually there would have turned out to be something more to it.
And also, it kind of opened, because the dwarfs who are effectively faintly Dewy for a lot of the books.
Do you think I saw they're like Welsh as well?
Because they've got, you know, because they nag, they've got, I may just be projecting my familial issues here. they've got these kind of hierarchical structures, they've got their bread, they make golems. Yeah.
I suppose that is the point, because the way that the immigration is dealt with is that the dwarves are kind of the good migrant, but the one that, because there's a great line where someone says, is your problem with the dwarves that they're lazy and they don't do anything, or that they're coming here and taking all our jobs? That, like, you can't put those two things together. But so, yeah, so the dwarves are the kind of, they're coming over here and taking all our jobs, to like Gimlet, the guy who makes whatever it is that he does. But whereas the trolls are scary immigrants in the sense that they are just much bigger, and
they do jobs like being bouncers. That was, and the slightly weird way was the way that I felt, and there were fairly established riffs he was making fun of with the dwarfs and the trolls, and fairly established types of prejudice. And then it kind of went, nope, now I'm gonna, and it did feel a bit too. I think, yeah, if I was going to point out when I felt the book started to decline, it would probably be Thud. Mm. I think Nightwatch to me is the last great Discworld novel.
I think that's a really interesting question, because so I've had loads of people say to me, what book should I read? Because I think when a canon is that big, it becomes terrifying, because you just think, well, am I going to kind of turn
I
up and not
recommend to me, as someone who's read, I think, six Discworld novels.
Well, what I said to my husband was that I think you should read the City Watch ones as a unit, because you go through, so first of all, you have Guards, which is, you introduce Samuel Vibes, he's a washed up drunk, you know, he's useless, the City Watch is in total disarray, it can't, you know, the streets are incredibly criminal, the patrician's desperately trying to get a grip on this thing. It's got a dragon, the dragon farts, jobs are good. And then you have Men-at-Arms, which is all about the invention of the gun and what that brings to the Discworld, and the fact that for the first time ever, people have a weapon that isn't purely, you know, exaggerating their muscles. It's a form of power that people can't control, and people find it incredibly seductive and what that does. And then what's the next one? The next one must be, Feet of Clay, which is my favourite of all of them, which is exploring the concept of kingship. So you juxtapose Captain Carrot, who doesn't want to be king. He has a different, you know, there's the model of the kind of ideal policeman, which is the man of the city, you know, the kind of civic authority, versus the golems, who try and make themselves a king and drive the king mad with all these things about what they want from it. And again, is a kind of interrogation of power. And then, is there another one before Nightwatch?
After Feet of Clay, there's Jingo, which is about war and is, I think, yeah, one of the best. And that's kind of when he becomes a duke. And then after that, you have...
And that's just quite a romp, actually, Jingo, because they go off and there's another war and they end up having a massive football match.
The Elephant, where they go, it's basically... That's when... Because one of the nice things is the way that... He will occasionally introduce people in fairly broad, and he always wanted to kind of get into their world. So having introduced werewolves and vampires earlier on, The Fifth Elephant was kind of one where we sort of went home to see, you know, where one of these werewolf characters had grown up, and it kind of... Yeah, he kind of both sent up and expanded these kind of fantasy clichés And then the fifth elephant, and then Night Watch.
And then you get Night Watch, which takes you back to the origin story of the Patrician, who's by that point a character that you find out a huge amount. So the idea behind the Patrician is that he is the ultimate ideal of a benevolent tyrant. He's worked out that what most people want is for tomorrow to be much like today. That's his model of government. And instead of carving up the pie, you grow the pie, which I think actually Labour politicians have now started saying unironically about how we should grow the pie. And he has a small amount of foibles, like he has a clock with an irregular tick-tock, so that by the time that people have waited for 10 minutes in his outer office, they've gone totally mad, because you just keep waiting for it, and then it doesn't do it quite at the time that you think it's going to do. And his only other vice apart from that is he does crosswords, and he hangs mime artists upside down in scorpion pits with a sign that says, "Learn the words," which I'm fully pro. But Night Watches is... I think you're right. It is the last great one, and it's written very much in a minor key. Yeah. It's very elegiac. Mm. So it's going back to a revolution that happened 20, 30 years before, in which lots of people died. And it's about that idea of what actually happens when you overthrow, what happens in a revolution. There are people involved in any revolution who have great ideals, but there are also the fixers, you know, the people who actually wield the knife or who organise the riot that tips things off, and the kind of hidden machinations of history. But I agree with you, it's a really difficult thing for Pratchett fans to deal with, because the books did decline. They became, I think he dictated a lot of them, and they became a lot more stream of consciousness. Mm. So there are, for the later books, it's more a case of kind of finding things that you previously loved in a sort of gushing river of prose. Whereas The Shepherd's Crown, I don't know what happened, is not like that. It does feel like, it feels tight and it feels structured. It actually feels not quite fleshed out. It feels as if someone's written the spine of the book, and maybe there would have been more things.
Well, that's what Rob says a bit in the afterword. I have read the afterword of it, where he says that probably Terry wouldn't have sent this book to the publisher quite yet. There would still have been more meat to put on its bones.
Yeah.
Although, because of the way he worked, it does still work as a... He didn't write from beginning to end, so it is still a completed story.
Yeah, I have no idea how Pratchett used to work, but it reminds me a lot of the way that... What Woodhouse used to do is he'd write a page, he'd stick it up on his wall, and he would move it up the wall as he kind of got the kind of, you know, the Woodhousian things about, you know, ice formed on the butler's upper slopes, that kind of phrase. And Douglas Adams, in his foreword to Sunset of Lanning, which is kind of Woodhouse's last novel, and like The Shepherd's Crown, it is finished, but it's not complete. Mm. He says, yeah, well, the problem with Sunset of Lanning is that not many of the pages would have made all the way up to the wall, which I think this one has, but clearly he started with bone and then added meat later, which means that actually... There is a more intact skeleton with this one, whereas
some of the other ones feel a bit oozy, don't they? They feel like they are lots of flesh, but actually not very much support structure. But I think one of the things that's fascinating is how badly they've translated to other media. I've tried several times to watch the TV versions. They made TV versions of the Moist Von Lippig ones, which again are a nice little self-contained series if you want to start somewhere. But they just didn't. I think maybe it's a budgetary thing. Things that look a bit kind of comic and low level when you're doing it on a TV budget.
I've seen the Hogfather adaptation, I think Sky did, and it looks rubbish. Mm. You know, just having an entire character who is a kind of non-existent astral projection, if you're not going to spend Hollywood money on that, it's just going to look rubbish.
But I also don't... Now I've thought about it slightly more, I'm not sure if it even is Hollywood money, because they poured an enormous amount of money into The Golden Compass, which was their version of the Philip Pullman, and it's still a bit weird. I think there are some genres... So Game of Thrones works on TV because it takes itself incredibly seriously. It's got a very obvious palette. You know, its fantasy elements aren't ridiculous. And that's the problem with Pratchett books, is from the very start, from the, you know, Light Fantastic and The Colour of Magic, it's played with the ridiculousness of fantasy genre. And it incredibly skillfully. But on TV, when you do have a golem lurching round and it looks like a sort of, you know, you can see that they've always had a tennis ball on a stick and look into the eyes. You don't get the subtlety, I guess, of the pastiche. Mm.
So what happens now to the Discworld?
Well, I mean, that's the big sort of fan debate. His daughter is going, well, They expected will continue them.
Yeah, they said that she'll continue to work with adaptation. So Rhianna Pratchett is a very accomplished writer in her own right. She worked on the Tomb Raider games, which were the reboot, which were really, well, I mean, a lot better than the plot of the previous Tomb Raider. And also on a game called Mirror's Edge. And she's written for comics and been a journalist as well. So, you know, she is absolutely, and she's his only child. So she's absolutely sort of steeped in the lore. And actually, weirdly, he has always been an author who has been very good at collaboration. Mm. So he collaborated with Stephen Briggs on the plays. There's been The Science of Discworld. There's been these books with Stephen Baxter, the Long Earth series.
Good Omens with Neil Gaiman,
which I've never... Everyone else absolutely loves, and I never really got. Should I give that another go?
Yeah, I think it's worth.
I like the radio adaptations of it. I haven't actually read it, but yeah, the radio version was really good.
It's aged surprisingly poorly already. In that a lot of the references, like, oh yeah, tapes in cars, that's a thing. But
that's why I think that the Discworld books themselves will age quite well, because they exist it is a completely alternate universe. And actually, one of the things that's been really interesting to see over, you start essentially with the first books in a pre-industrial society, and then a lot of the later ones, particularly the Ankh Morpork books, are all about industrialization. This book there's a sort of weird sort of sub part of this book, which is all about, so the elves hate iron, which already came up in Lords and Ladies, because I think they were sort of, you know, like Magret shot one with an iron bolt through the keyhole in the eye, and people hit them with crowbars. But now there is a railway, there is essentially like a kind of rivers of iron running across the Discworld. And they have swarf, this thing, which is basically iron filings that, you know, they use industrial processes. The time, like the elves' time is over. They can never kind of now conquer the Discworld because it has become too industrialized. So that's all happening. But you're right, there are no specific, it's never going to be like, you know, Vimes popped a VHS cassette into his player and like loaded up Home and Away, and you'd be like, oh, this feels really weirdly out of date.
So is Rhianna Pratchett going to write new books, or...?
It's still not sure. When he did an interview with Laurie Penny, he said, you know, she's in charge of my legacy, so I guess it's really up to her what she wants to do. There has been definitely talk about a TV series. But there are so many... I mean, this is the thing, that there are so many of them. It feels slightly churlish to kind of complain about there not being more, when very few authors have left so many books of such high quality.
And also, as I mean, you referenced P.G. Woodhouse there, he's one author, Agatha Christie's another,
Ian Fleming,
where the estate has appointed contemporary authors to carry on, and I don't think there's been a good one yet.
Well, I read that P.G. Woodhouse, the Sebastian Foulkes one, and it reads like someone doing a bad party impression, because like you were saying, Stephen, you know, the kind of the upper slopes, or the kind of, you know,
the rhythm is just off,
or you know, duchesses were wearing a chair which was being worn very tight on the hips this season. Yeah. You know, those P.G. Woodhouse-isms, people tend to copy that. They think if they can come up with a great kind of thing that sounds like a P.G. Woodhouse-ism, then that's it, they've got it nailed. And the problem with the signature of Pratchett above anything else is the sheer inventiveness of looking through things the wrong end of the telescope. It's coming up with things. So, for example, he has his version of Leonardo da Vinci is Leonardo Quirm, who is tormented by the fact that he comes up with consistently with huge numbers of inventions, almost all of which are completely useless. And it requires a huge amount of creativity to actually carry that through and come up with amusing examples of what those things would be. And that's the bit I think anyone else will struggle to replicate. Whereas I think you could take the characters very well, but would you be able to, at the kind of granular level?
Yeah, I think there's a danger it would end up like the awful Owen Colfer Hitchhiker's Guide.
Oh, I didn't read that because I thought, no.
It's bad. Sorry if you are, in fact, a listener to this podcast.
Or indeed Owen Colfer. Sorry. Yeah.
Sorry, Owen, but you know it's bad. It doesn't have the Adam Zeit voice, and that same ability to kind of go, oh, this entry. And I think it would be a bit of a shame in some ways, because she is such a good writer. I hadn't realised she'd also done Mirror's Edge, that I think it's a shame when we kind of like go, no, you must do more of this. And there are so many of them, you know, there are, I hadn't realised, and there's The Carpet People, which I haven't read. And we haven't talked about the Johnny books.
Well, see, this is my thing. So I read Carpet People, which he wrote in two versions. He wrote an original version when he was like 19, and then he rewrote it at the age of 40 when he was like, now I actually know how to write. But I haven't read any of Johnny the Dead trilogy.
The Johnny books are really good. The Johnny books also has my favourite character in Pratchett, Yolus, which at some point on a quiet Friday afternoon I will inflict a piece about Yolus on the internet, so keep your eyes peeled for that, listeners.
But yeah, so that's my concluding thought, which is that although I can see the temptation to expand the franchise and continue to kind of most of us could probably just work on a cycle where we just start again at the beginning and reread them all through.
There is a whole world there to discover.
For the rest of our lives, yeah. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.